540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Five Americans detained in Iran will be reuniting with family members at Fort Belvoir in Virginia and getting health checkups. CBS's Margaret Brennan with more on the prisoner swap.
In return, five Iranian nationals were granted clemency. Two will remain in the U.S. Two others returned to Iran today. Critics of the hostage diplomacy worried the regime will now, as part of the deal, have access to $6 billion worth of unfrozen Iranian oil assets held in a restricted account in Qatar.
These monies can be used to support terrorist organizations, Hezbollah, Hamas, and venturesome actions of Iran.
That's Republican Mike Turner, chair of the House Intelligence Committee. A defense official says searchers have found the wreckage of a missing Marine Corps F-35 fighter jet in a Williamsburg County, Virginia cotton field. That's a South Carolina cotton field. CBS's David Martin reports.
Last month, the Marines suffered two fatal crashes. An F-18 in California, in which the pilot died, and a V-22 Osprey in Australia, in which three Marines died. There's no evidence of a common cause, but after the loss of the F-35, the Marines ordered an immediate two-day safety stand-down for all aviation units to review basic flying procedures.
New details are coming to light about the suspected fentanyl exposure of four children at a daycare center in New York City. Police say the powerful opioid was found under a mat where the children had been napping. One-year-old boy died. New York City Health Commissioner Ashwin Vasan says his team of inspectors had recently visited the facility.
I'm very sorry, but one of the things my child care inspectors are not trained to do is look for fentanyl. But maybe we need to start. But that has not been a part of our thinking for decades or years in doing this work.
Progress reported as United Auto Workers resume bargaining talks with GM, Ford, and Stellantis after the union launched a strike 4 days ago. Strike Captain Kyle O'Shea at the Stellantis plant in Toledo, Ohio, one of the three plants so far that are part of the targeted walkout.
This is for the entire middle class. This is for the working class. We're here representing not only us, but everyone out there.
Meantime, Ford has cut 600 non-union jobs, and GM is threatening to cut 2,000 positions. Cash bail is no more in Illinois. A law called the Safety Act takes effect after lawsuit objections from law enforcement and prosecutors. Whether to detain a suspect will be up to a judge's discretion based on background and the nature of the crime. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox.
This effort to detain those who pose a real threat to our public, rather than detain those who are simply poor, is the right thing to do.
This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Waukesha's new water isn't flowing today. Officials announced late last week that October 9th is the new target date after initially thinking it could happen this week. The delay is allowing for testing, reservoir flushing, and fixing programming problems with water pumps. The transition, once it happens, is expected to take several weeks, and it may lead to temporary water discoloration and odor. Milwaukee police are still searching for three missing foster care children who left their school together Friday. WISN 12 reports the kids share the same biological mother, and it was suggested that they may have left the school to be with her. The children are in foster care, but specific details about their foster family aren't known. Police are actively investigating the case with no indications of abduction or immediate danger to the children. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Red Delicious Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, Ontario.
Fritos, Cheetos, Doritos. We should expect that stuff to be safe. Why does it make sense that corporations can poison the American people and we don't even know about? Politically, there is a group who chooses to make sure that there are not enough dollars put into the Food and Drug Administration to check on these types of things.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. This includes a commitment to news. Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to a Civic Media radio station. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Act. Germany enacted a new law banning installations of most oil and gas heating systems starting in 2024.
Good.
Critics say the law's targets were watered down, but it will still cut emissions from the home heating sector by nearly two-thirds. And finally, encouraging news for building electrification, a new study finds that even in sub-zero temperatures, all electric heat pumps actually outperform fossil fuels. Even at temperatures down to minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit, electric heat pumps are twice as efficient and cheaper than oil and gas heating systems. And that may be why in Norway, electric heat pumps today make up almost all heating installations.
And beginning next year, a whole bunch of Americans are going to be able to put heat pumps into their own homes and have them paid for under the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yep.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Evidently, we have hit 33 trillion dollars in debt. At least that's what every right-wing conservative group in the country emailing me saying, send us money so we can stop spending money. It was kind of funny. I had to laugh. I got to tell you, I had to give it a chuckle. You know, when you're saying, hey, we're spending too much money, send us some money. The country's broke. You owe all this money. Send us money. It's really kind of twisted, bizarre, but it's where we are. And it got me thinking today that, you know, there's a bunch to this debt number. And look, I'm one of those people who believes you pay your bills. I've always said I'm a tax and spend liberal. I believe we tax the very wealthy and we spend it on things we need. Roads, bridges, education, healthcare, that kind of stuff. And we are doing just the opposite of what we should be doing on this front. So I sat down today and I was thinking about, you know, how did we get in my lifetime, in the years that I have had a job, how did we go from less than $1 trillion in debt to 33 trillion? How did we do this? How did we get here? Because, you know, if you listen to any of those economic gurus, when you find yourself in debt, you got to figure out what the driver was. You got to figure out what it was. How'd you get here? How did you get here? And, you know, when Reagan took office in 1981, the country was less than $1 trillion in debt. We were $998 billion in debt. And that had been fairly consistent since the end of World War II. But more importantly, what we were is debt to GDP ratio, 31%. I don't know an American who wouldn't be thrilled to be in debt, in the debt to ratio, GDP ratio of 31%. Not quite sure. But we went during his term, his 8 years, he ran up nearly $2 trillion in debt, cutting taxes, Star Wars, defense spending, all kinds of stuff. Then comes H.W. Bush. In H.W. Bush's 4 years, he ran up $1.6 trillion in debt. Now remember, he ran on, trouble. I'm never going to raise taxes. And then it was, read my lips. I see how bad it is. During Clinton's 8 years, we went from $4.4 trillion to $5.8, or $1.4 trillion in increase of the debt during his 4 years. So if you're looking at this, if you're doing the score, to this point, you're looking at, you know, Reagan and Bush, $3.6 trillion, Clinton, $1.4, and then the W years come. The 8 years under W, we go $6.1 trillion deeper into debt, up to almost $12 trillion. During the Obama years, $9.7 trillion. But remember, when Obama took office, the economy had completely cratered thanks to corporate Democrats and Republicans undoing Glass-Steagall, allowing the country to collapse economically. And we had massive, massive spending needs at the beginning. So almost a little bit of a caveat for the Obama years. And then Trump comes in. We're $20.2 trillion in debt. Remember, he was going to wipe it out. He was going to pay it all off. All $20 trillion, he was going to get paid off. Not only did we not pay it off, he increased about $9.4 trillion in just 4 years. So now here we're sitting at, you know, almost $30 trillion. And then President Biden comes in. And again, another massive economic calamity thanks to a Republican and their policies. And now we're here at $33 trillion. So I came down to what's happened. You go back to Reaganomics. You know, our Reagan acolytes, you know, even, you know, the Reagan Democrats, the Reagan Revolution, you know, the people who hate working people. What they did, the transformation they made in this country's thinking, is that if we give the rich people everything that they want, eventually they'll share it. Which we know that's not true. We know that's never going to happen. We absolutely, positively, without question, know that's never going to happen. But somehow, you know, like Lucy and like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football, we keep doing it. And you look at all of the tax cut after tax cut fetish, because this time working people, something's going to trickle down to you. And it doesn't ever really get down to us. And you look at, you know, the moment that Reagan took office, we're, you know, a 31% debt to GDP ratio, less than $1 trillion in debt. And to this point here, we're now $33 trillion in debt and 123% debt to GDP ratio. And what do we have to show for it? Well, we have to show a large billionaire class. We've got the largest billionaire class in history. We've chosen to enrich the handfuls, the shareholders, the CEO class, the, you know, the donor class, the capitalists. We have taken care of them very well. Thank you very much. And it got me thinking, you know, that the guy who wrote the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but, you know, he said, you know, rich people don't pay taxes because they don't have any income. And it got me thinking through this. Because I'm looking at what's happening right now with the UAW and the strike going on at the big three. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, here, we started off in the Reagan years. Those UAW jobs were the gold standard of employment in this country. You got one of those jobs, you were going to lead not just a middle class existence, but an upper middle class existence. People were jealous of those jobs. They paid good wages, had incredible benefits, had retirement security, all kinds of things. The union fought for good stuff. And Reagan firing the Patco workers and the shot heard across the boardroom and open season on unions to today, what you have are those auto worker jobs, from what I'm now finding out, are not great. They're actually fairly crummy. And the wages, especially if you're a new person in the two-tier system, really not great. So, you know, I'm looking at this strike going, you know, there's a couple of things at play here. you know, obviously the wages, hours, conditions, and obviously the future of that job and that work, that's a big part of it. But the other part for me, and this is what, you know, I think of things in historical perspective. You know, you think back to the sit-down strikes of the 30s. You think back to the Lordstown UAW strike of the 70s that fought for a social change. And you go, could this be one of those moments where, as a country, this strike is the catalyst to get us a mind change, kind of shake us awake, a little therapy from the Stockholm syndrome I think workers have been suffering for the last 40 years. Because here's the thing. What they're saying is, look, the CEO class, the people making $22, $25, $29 million a year, these are the people telling us, sorry, we can't give you a raise up to $22 an hour. Just can't do it. You know, people who their salary for 1 year is more than these people will make in a lifetime are saying, sorry, we just can't do that. We can't give you raises because we would have to, you know, share. Now, understand, over the last 10 years, the big three auto companies have made $250 billion. And where has that profit gone? Well, they've redistributed it through dividends and share to the shareholders, stock buybacks. They announced, the three of them, $5 billion in stock buybacks. This year alone, the first 6 months of this year alone, $21 billion in profit. So the question is, where does all that money go? Well, we know where it goes. It goes to the shareholders. It goes to the CEOs. It goes to the wealthy. Overwhelmingly, it goes up. There's a giant sucking sound, if I could use a Ross Perot-ism. There's a giant sucking sound, and that's money coming out of your paycheck going into generations yet to be born of the wealth class, their pockets. And right now, you've got the UAW saying, look, you know, the Sean Fain, the president, saying, this is this generation's, this is their moment. This is history calling. This is an opportunity to, well, distribute wealth the way it had once been before Ronald Reagan. Because when you stop and you think about it, 1981, the top marginal tax rate in this country for our rich people at the top was 70%. Kennedy had lowered it from 92 down to 70 in the early 60s, and Reagan took it all the way down to 28, which, boom, are you surprised? Surprise, we're going in debt. Because you don't have the revenue. Now they'll say, no, no, more revenue came in. And for a short period of time, rich people paid their taxes and then invested in certain things that generated more income. That is true. But over the long haul, what's it done? Well, it starved schools of funding. It starved the government of resources to be able to do the things that it needs to do. You know, like war. I mean, you go back to the Eisenhower years. You go back to the Truman years. You know, we had war. And we paid for them. I know we're a war society, but we actually paid for them. Not like now where it's, yeah, we'll put it on the credit card. So the question that I have is, when do we get tired of corporate America crying poverty every time workers want their share of the wealth that they create? When do we stop, you know, allowing the Mary Barras of the world to say, hey, you know, we just can't possibly pay you a reasonable wage. I know my 20 some odd million dollars can't do that. And didn't she recently say we need to get the U.S. auto workers in line with the rest of the auto workers in the country? You know, poverty wages and desperate conditions and no benefits. Yeah. So the question I have is, will we put up with it? How do you see this strike going? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We- We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big story today is that the UAW turned down a 21% increase. And look, I don't think they should take anything this early that isn't close to the 40 that they're demanding. Because look, if the CEO class can pocket the 40% for themselves, I think workers earn much more than what they're getting. I don't like to use the word deserve because they earn it. They're the ones. And I love what Sean Fain said. You know, if the shareholders want to keep getting this kind of money, maybe they should learn how to build cars. That's a good way of putting it. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Steve on line one. Steve in Chicago. Steve, how are you?
Good. And I wanted to expand on some of the issues that you've already raised. So one, people shouldn't be under any delusion with regard to what CEOs are actually making. So sometimes we hear numbers, $10, $20, $30 million a year. A lot of times that is not the full extent of their compensation. That's what they're making officially.
Right.
Unofficially, a lot of these people get all sorts of other perks. So in other words, okay, you sign on as CEO, we're going to, you know, rent you a $20 million penthouse apartment in Manhattan where you'll live. And we're going to give you a driver and a car and access to private jets. And then, of course, you know, you get to, if the stock price hits what we hope it's going to hit during your tenure, you get to buy it at today's prices down the road when it's actually gone up. But you get to pay today's prices.
Yep.
And then sell it at your discretion. So make no mistake, these people are making a lot more money than you think because they're getting in the way of non-money in terms of compensation. A whole lot of things that you and I would otherwise have to pay for out of our salaries.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an entirely different world. So it's basically a way to avoid Uncle Sam because you don't have to pay a tax on that kind of perk in many cases.
Yeah. But no, a lot of that came out, if you remember, Steve, when Jack Welch got divorced. I don't know if you saw what came out of the divorce settlement. All of the perks that he got in retirement for the rest of his life, sporting tickets to the Yankees, to the Red Sox, to hockey, to basketball, all that stuff. You multiple apartments to live in, a secretary, you know, round the clock, floral service, private jet access, all. Just, it was obscene, the amount of perks that he got.
Exactly.
On top of the enormous amount of cash. So just to prove your point, yeah, I mean, they get lavish everything.
Yes, exactly. It's basically, you know, it's akin to, you know, not being the king any longer, but you're still considered royalty because you're taken care of in perpetuity, the sort of thing that happened in court at one time when we had monarchical rule. Beyond that, you know, we need to distinguish between the kind of debt that you accumulate as a country. You know, there's good debt and bad debt. Bad
Absolutely.
Debt is, you know, going to Las Vegas and blowing through a couple of $100,000, you know, playing craps, roulette, whatnot. Okay, good debt is borrowing a couple of $100,000 to go to medical school and ending up as a world-class anesthesiologist in 10, 15 years. So when we have gone into debt to do things like build infrastructure and invest in education and all sorts of other things, okay, that's good debt because the return on that is exponentially greater than the initial investment. And it's amazing how in the private sector that logic works perfectly well. If you invest in expanding your company, your corporation, research and development, all sorts of things, you're going to have greater market share, greater profit. But when you apply that same logic to our society, no, we can't do that sort of thing. We can't borrow money to invest in people and our institutions, which are invariably are going to trickle down to everyone. No, we can't do that. So, I mean, it always amazes me how their logic applies. And the other problem is that we have this perverse incentive system whereby in capitalism, you become the CEO of Corporation X. You have no incentive to negotiate with workers during a strike. You have no incentive to build out the research and development portions of the company or to build new factories that are in the long run going to produce more. Why? Because you're not going to be there that long. CEO tenures don't tend to be that long. And the way in which you're compensated is short term. How's our stock going to do over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, sometimes even 6 months? And then I'll be gone, and it's the next guy's concern.
Yep.
This is why there was some advantage when families owned large corporations, because they had an incentive to invest because they were leaving it to their kids and their grandkids. Today, CEOs come in, and it's just about, okay, cut the workforce where we can, push up the stock, do whatever we can to maximize what's going to make me the bottom line in terms of my compensation package, because I'm gone in a few years.
Yeah.
And that creates a huge disincentive to be as productive as we can, and that's the problem. I mean, nobody wants to be the person who's the CEO today of the big three negotiating, because, you know, if the workers do get decent contracts, the shareholders are not going to be happy with that, and that means the stock prices are going to take a hit, and that means that these CEOs, the bottom line, is going to take a hit. They were hoping, you know, maybe somebody down the road would have to deal with this problem, so that, you know, they would take the hit. But no, instead it's going to be the CEO. So make no mistake, these people have a vested interest in not seeing this happen.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the reality is, you know, you were talking about, you know, the CEO staying around a short period of time and then moving on. You know, Robert Nardelli popped into my head, the former CEO of Home Depot. And then when they fired him, because of his contract, and this is why I say every working person should have a contract, because of his contract, when they fired him, they had to pay him $210 million plus a whole bunch of perks out the door. And within, you know, months, he got the CEO gig at Chrysler, which came with a boatload of money. It's like they never lose. They're never shown the door like working people are. And they're always looking for their next gig to cash in. And you're spot on right on that.
It's failing upward. I mean, these people are just around. It could be a CEO of a terrible company that does horribly, and then they move on to another CEO package deal. And we talked about this because it's this incestuous relationship. They sit on each other's boards, and they make sure that they take care of one another. So when you end up being CEO, you make sure that your friends are on the board of that corporation, and they vote with you. And on occasion, there is this power play in which somebody attempts to remove someone else and that sort of thing. But by and large, it's everyone taking care of everyone else and making sure their interests are served. And it's that little party of people inside, and the rest of us have our faces pressed against the window looking inside from out. And they're going to make sure that as few people are in there as possible, because in their mind, there's only so much of the pie to go around, and there's only so many people that can be at that table. And it's not the vast majority of the rest of us.
Yeah, we're not getting in the room. I'm with you, Steve. I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, you see, he's spot on right. I mean, this is, I wish every working person thought like this. And look, he's talking about good debt and bad debt. And as Steve was, you know, bringing this up, my mind is actually going through this $33 trillion and how some of it is really bad debt. You think about all of the bank bailouts that have happened over the years. You think about every time the capitalists crash the economy and say, you know, hey, you know, sorry, working people, if you don't give us, you know, billions and trillions of dollars, you're all going to suffer. And I was going through year by year of, you know, market crash and savings and loan crisis and, you know, this banking crisis. And, you know, you've got the war in 91, you've got the war on terror, you got all of this bad spending. And this is where conservatives get me. I'm with you on, we need to stop spending badly and maybe take some of that and spend it in the right areas. You know, Eisenhower had an enormous, you know, spending package. Roads and bridges, largest investment in public infrastructure in the country's history. You know, Joe Biden with the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. And that, not even close to enough. And the thing is, you know, by not having the investment money, we're making it much more difficult on average, everyday working people. And you go, well, how does that trickle down to us? I think back to my grandparents. You know, in the 40s and 50s, you know, the 50s really, you know, there was a lot of money being spent on infrastructure into the early 60s. A lot of money through the GI Bill being spent on homes, being spent on building communities. There were Levittown-type communities all over the country. And you look now, we're not doing that kind of investment. And you wonder why. Because I was reading a story earlier today that said, you know, it's hard for people to buy homes. There's, you know, what would they say? It's a shortage of housing, and renters just can't afford to buy and all this stuff. And you go, yeah, it's because government has stopped investing in this stuff and corporate America has gotten into buying everything up. I was talking to a kid over the weekend. Young guy wants to buy his own home. And he was saying, look, I want to find a fixer-upper. And I'm going, good luck. Because you're not going to find them, because the institution of flipping them, all of those people have sucked up all of those entry-level homes that you could put some sweat equity into. And he was distraught because the houses that he would want to buy are way, way out of his price range. And for a young family to try and start out, you know, in buying that starter home, that's gone. And it's all these flippers and all these corporate investors who are buying those properties up to rent out. And our government hasn't been doing anything to move us in a better direction. We have a housing crisis in this country. And as I've said, one of the things I would love to see the Biden administration do is start building some of those communities like where my grandparents bought, where, you know, every house looks just almost the same. You know, there's a variation. They flip the rooms around a little bit. But, you know, they're, you know, 1,200-1,300-foot bungalows and affordable quality. Good starters, that's what we should be working on. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1951. That was the day pineapple workers on the island of Lanai emerged victorious. ILWU Local 142 workers were back on the job after 7 months on strike against the Hawaiian Pineapple Company. It was the first contract signed by the new big union that had recently organized 35,000 sugar and pineapple workers. Local newspapers rejoiced that the long silent whistle signaling workers back to the world's largest pineapple plantation was finally blowing. The workers on other islands ended their strike in May for an 8-cent an hour wage increase. Lanai workers held out for additional demands. They wanted an end to the anti-Filipino discrimination they faced in wages and housing and the poor treatment they endured from their bosses. Historian Dionisio Naden Valdez notes that, quote, the ultimate concern was equal treatment and dignity for Filipinos. For decades, a colonized workforce lacking citizenship rights. It was a further step towards building interracial unionism. The press, of course, vilified the strikers, red-baiting their union leaders, and extolling the virtues of the company for bringing progress to the island. But the union won big. They re-established pattern bargaining lost in an earlier strike. They also secured additional wage increases, dues collection, seniority rights, inexpensive housing, and medical coverage. Importantly, there were contract provisions that addressed mechanization and de-skilling of work. The union was finally in a position to change unfair job classifications, winning higher pay for the jobs that required operation of new machinery. What the union could not control in the long run was what Valdez referred to as the runaway plantation. By the 1970s, employment had plummeted as companies fled union fields for cheaper land and labor in Thailand and the Philippines.
Corporate and governmental hucksters intentionally cloak their schemes in convoluted obfuscations so we commoners can't really know what they're saying or doing to us. That's why our Hightower Lowdown team takes pride in regularly trying to deconstruct their arcane jargon, translating it into plain language. Recently, for example, I pointed out the slick deceit in Big Pharma's assertion that its outrageously high drug prices are just a factor of, quote, core cost recovery. Huh? That's supposed to mean that it costs a lot to do basic research for discovering new medicines, so they must recover those costs. But wait, I hollered, basic drug research is not paid for by brand-name corporate monopolists. Rather, this essential humane work is done by such public entities as the National Institutes of Health. paid for by us taxpayers. And it's a huge tax-paid subsidy. In 2020, a study by the Institute of New Economic Thinking laid out the scam in stark terms, quote, "Taxpayers have been footing the bill for every new drug approved between 2010 and 2019. Hello, every new drug. The Institute's study traced the funding of 356 new drugs approved in that period, finding that a whopping $230 billion in public finance research paid for the basic science that created the medicines. In what the researchers called a robust pipeline to industry, monopolistic patents were then obtained on those ingredients by Big Pharma to market drugs made possible by the scientific capital we taxpayers invested." This is Jim Hightower saying, for drug profiteers, this is manna from heaven. The system hands new drug products to them, letting them arbitrarily fix prices that enrich their investors with nearly double the profit levels of other corporate powers. If you suspect the system is rigged to gouge you, there it is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, got a number of communications on the UAW strike. And look, I'm all in. I think this can be transformational. I have great hope that Sean Fain and the leadership is pushing in the right direction, not just to change what's going on at the big three, but potentially all across every industry as we start asking the question, why is it we're enriching the very wealthy at the expense of the person who's doing the actual work? I'm sure hoping. But over the weekend, I got email from a guy who said he believed that the strike was Joe Biden's fault. And I agreed with him. This is Biden's fault. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, maybe how, or if it is. I'm not going to put words in his mouth. We're going to find out if this is Joe Biden's fault. That's why I've asked Mike Williams to come talk with us. Mike is a senior fellow for domestic climate at the Domestic Climate Center at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick. I always love being here.
So let's get to it. Is this Biden's fault? Did Biden do this? Are we going to see a sticker with him pointing at the strike going, I did that?
You know what's interesting, Rick? When you empower working people, when the politics actually work, when you elect the politicians who will actually work for you, and that's Joe Biden, they feel empowered to actually stand up. And so in that way, yeah, maybe it is his quote unquote fault, or maybe he deserves some credit for creating the space so that this transformational effort that's being put forth by President Fain and the auto workers, all of the workers there, the 150,000 of them, to step up and demand what they deserve.
Yep. What they earn. I hate that word deserve. It's what they earn. They're the ones who create the wealth. They're the ones who show up and do the midnight shift. They're the ones who bleed and sweat. They're the ones who walk home with sore backs and sore muscles. They create the wealth. They earn it. They should get a bigger share of it. And that's, for me, very simple.
That's right. And the other part of this too, Rick, so actually there's two other parts of this. The first, President Biden is the most pro-union president, definitely in my lifetime and maybe in this country's history. So he's done that not just because of the legislation he's pushed, the Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure bill that had labor standards attached to it, but in every way he can, he's using the power of the federal government to try to lift up and support working people and specifically union workers. But then the other part of this is he is helping usher in a push towards cleaner vehicles, towards electric vehicles. And people are rightfully, perhaps especially those who work in the industry, might be concerned about that transition. But guess what? The world is moving that direction. China is building absolutely tons of cheap, crappy electric vehicles, and they're going to start dumping them on the markets. So should we do what the other guy, Trump, says and say, no, we're not going to do electric vehicles. We're going to just keep building the gas-powered cars we have for the last 100 years and just stick our heads in the sand and then just poof, lose the industry? Or are we going to do what President Biden and Congress and actually the UAW has said they support and invest in our future and make it so we have auto jobs for the next generation?
That sounds like common sense. Sounds like smart policy. Maybe if we would have done that with other industries in the past, go down the line of industries that we've lost because of outsourcing or because of technological changes that then get outsourced. Had we done this kind of a just transition, and that's, I guess, the buzzword that they're using now. Had we done this now, maybe the working class wouldn't be in the condition it's in right now.
That's exactly right. And that phrase, just transition, which has been maligned and in potentially a lot of ways, rightfully so. But this is our chance to do a just transition right. And the UAW is stepping up and taking control of their future and saying, you know what? We get it. Electric vehicles are part of not just our future, but our present. But we want to be the ones building them, and the people building them, they're our members, and even outside of our members, they should be making the proper, decent wages that they have earned. And you rightfully corrected me. I said the word deserve. You're right that they've earned in doing this. So electric vehicle jobs that make batteries for electric vehicles, they should be paid what other auto workers make. Mind blowing. But that's part of what the UAW is fighting for.
Yeah. Look, I've been talking about for the last couple of days the fact that these auto worker jobs, these were the gold standard of the American working class. And I've told the story a thousand times. When I was a kid growing up in the projects, the neighbor got a job at Ford, got a UAW job, and immediately their lives got better. They had food at the end of the month. Kids got bikes. They got a car, a secondhand car. They eventually moved out of the projects altogether. Their lives got incredibly better because the wages were superior. The benefits were superior. You worked your butt off, but your life got better. I'm looking at the wages now, and I was just reading them. I'm going, that family that lived next door to me, they couldn't have done half of the things they did with the job currently with the conditions we're seeing right now. And that's not helpful.
No. So, Rick, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I saw it earlier today. People were quoting the Henry Ford thing, like the $5 a day on the line. Auto workers once made $5 a day. Like, yeah, that was 1920 something. Yeah. Do you know what that is today? It's like 120 or something like that. It's something like $70 an hour or something along those lines. I don't remember the math, so don't quote me on it, although we're live, so somebody will quote me on it. Regardless, they can figure out the math. It is way beyond what they're making now.
Yep.
Auto worker wages have not kept up with inflation. That's one. That's why when people get scared, like, oh, they want a 40% raise, and guess what? They haven't had one since 2007. And to save their industry, they created a second lower tier of workers who come in at a significantly lower wage, making $20 an hour or something at this point.
17, I saw, which is
17
crazy.
An hour. And in some of the battery facilities, they're making 15 an hour. That you can't support a family on wages like that. You can. So when you're talking about a 40% wage, we're literally just catching up to where they should be, let alone what they would be if they were making the, back then, Henry Ford, $5 a day, the wages that would make it so they can afford an F-150 Lightning. Make it so they can afford a Jeep. They can't right now on these wages.
No, look, on $17 an hour, you can't afford any of the Ford cars, any of the trucks, because I've looked at them. They are not cheap. And those prices are going somewhere. And I think I know exactly where. They're going into the CEO's pockets. They make over $22 to $29 million a year. They're going into the shareholders' pockets. A $5 billion stock buyback, I guess, this year is what the three are talking about. Plus, $250 billion in profits over the last 10 years that didn't trickle down into the pockets of the people who actually created that wealth. And this, again, is where I come back to. I'm hoping that the rest of us who have been beaten for the last 40 years into submission, see this as an opportunity to go, hey, if they can do it, if they can win, maybe we can too. And this begins a snowball effect of people going, you know what? We can fight for better wages, hours, conditions. We can fight for the just transition.
Absolutely. And we can see this in multiple places. The Teamsters, in a very tense negotiation with UPS, they won. And they have huge 150% increase in people looking for jobs to be Teamsters, to be UPS drivers. Amazing. No workforce shortage there. Amazing how that works, right? We see it in the writers and the actors who are worried about getting replaced by artificial intelligence, and they have every right to be, because the greedy Hollywood producers are definitely going to do that. So they're standing up and saying no. And the auto workers are standing at the precipice of probably the biggest transformation in their industry that they've ever seen, and that anybody who's worked in that industry has ever seen. And they're standing up and saying, we want to be part of that future. We're standing here and we're claiming our right as part of that future because we have built the wealth that this industry has created. So more power to them. And you're exactly right. We need more of this. We need more of this. So everybody who cares even a little bit about the success of the American economy, the success of American people, should be rooting for the auto workers here.
No, and this is where I bring this back to why every working person should care. You know, why you should do what I've been saying for the last, you know, couple of years, adopt a striker, get out there on a picket line, walk with them, bring a couple of bottles of water, a pizza, something, drop a donation into their strike fund, because their victory is, you know, that rising tide lifting all boats and will help everybody. So for me, this is that community moment. This is that solidarity moment.
Yep, exactly. Exactly right. And I'm glad you brought up CEO pay, because it's one of the things that just drives me nuts. The claims of, oh, we're going to go bankrupt if we have to give such big bonuses. And to see the salary, the Stellantis CEO made $25 million last year. $25 million. One dude made $25 million. And we've got people on the line who are working 10 to 16 hour days, making 17 bucks an hour. What? And this is what we're fighting. It's horrifying. So yes, just again, if I'm repeating myself, you're exactly right. People should be supporting the UAW, adopt a striker. I wholeheartedly support that, Rick. And we'll come out better after this.
You know, this is one of those moments, again, I keep coming back to this because I think it's important. We've got rich people telling working people that they're asking for too much. We've got millionaires and billionaires telling people who work for 17, 18, 19 bucks an hour that their demands are too much and that the company will go out of, they'll go broke, they'll go bankrupt. And what's interesting to me is you look how profitable they've been over the last several years. They don't seem to want to share any of that wealth. Yet, when they were in trouble, what was the first thing they did when they got in trouble?
Ask for bailouts
and concessions from the workers. And what did they get? Massive concessions.
Yes.
You know, everyone tells me, oh, you know, the auto workers got bailed out during the Obama years. They didn't get bailed out. They got
the auto companies got bailed out. The CEOs got bailed out. And the workers stood up and they were part of the people who were bailing them out.
Yep.
They cut into their own future earnings to save the rear ends of the CEOs and the companies. So that's insane. Nobody should say the auto workers ever got bailed out. They're the ones who were bailing the water out of the sinking ship of the auto industry. Them and the Obama administration, who also should deserve credit for saving them.
Yeah, but the one thing that the auto workers did get to save is their pensions. That's one of the first times, and that's what everyone's ticked off about. That's what the wealthy are ticked off about. They didn't get to steal those workers' pensions. I got to ask you this, though. You know, I remember the Obama years, and I remember Obama saying that he had comfortable shoes and he was going to get out and walk on picket lines. I didn't see him in Wisconsin. I didn't see him put those comfortable shoes on ever. I've been saying Joe Biden should borrow those shoes because they're not well used. And he should get out there and walk in the picket line, because ultimately, I think he's responsible in positive ways, promoting unionism and promoting the next generation of employment that they're fighting for. Any thoughts?
So it would be amazing if he showed up. He's already voiced his support in stronger words than we ever saw of a strike this big from any president. I mean, I just saw a quote from Bernie Sanders saying, President Biden has shown in his statements how strong of a supporter he is of the UAW. Him showing up in the picket line would be just an amazing show of support. He did record a video for the Amazon workers. So, I mean, you know, President Joe is there.
Yeah.
But the visual of the picket line is pretty amazing. The last day or so, he's had Vladimir Zelensky from Ukraine in town. UN General Assembly, he's meeting with President Lula, doing an event on working people with, you know, the working class hero of Brazil. So I get it. He's president. He's got quite a lot to do right now, and we need him to do that. We need him to be that president for all of us. But yeah, I mean, It would be something else, right?
See, but I see this as a moment that could really politically help him. Outside of, you know, really helping working people and setting, but politically, this could be that moment where you go, look, I hear you, I'm with you. You know, going into those small towns that have been just eviscerated over the years as these big corporations have just abandoned, you know, place after place, you know, saying, look, we're behind you. We're going to have your back. To me, that's the messaging in that is so important.
I don't disagree. And you know what's it? I mean, because his actions back that up. And so this would be him showing up and saying, you know, I've had your back doing the work in D.C., but I'm showing up here and I got your back, too. It would be the full picture. It would be pretty darn cool.
Any final thoughts?
Keep fighting the good fight, Rick. This is, you know, Solidarity Summer is moving into Solidarity Fall. I hope the worker action doesn't stop. We need it. We need it to help make sure that we have a strong, clean economy for everyone. And yeah, otherwise, that's all I got.
Heading in the right direction. That's my thought. Mike, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much. Mike Williams, he is he's a senior fellow at the Domestic Climate Center for the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1895. That was the day that Booker T. Washington delivered what came to be known as the Atlanta Compromise Speech, which outlined his vision for race relations and black labor in the South. Washington was the founder of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, a college designed to train black students for careers in teaching, farming, and other trades. Washington was invited to give an address to the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta. It was the first time that a black man was asked to speak before a black and white Southern audience. In his speech, he urged Southern landowners and business leaders to employ black labor over European immigrants. He said, quote, "To those of the white race who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth and strange tongue and habits for the prosperity of the South, were I permitted, I would repeat what I say to my own race. Cast down your bucket where you are." He continued, "Cast it down among those people who have, without strikes and labor wars, tilled your fields, cleared your forests, built your railroads and cities, and brought forth treasures from the bowels of the earth and helped make possible this magnificent representation of the progress of the South." His speech outlined a plan for gradual black economic advancement. He declared, quote, "Agitation of questions of social equality is the extremist folly." Other black leaders, most notably W.E. Du Bois, rejected Booker T. Washington's idea of gradual advancement. Instead, Du Bois fought racial discrimination through the legal system and helped to found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email from Terry in Santa Fe. I didn't remember the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and she pointed out Robert Kiyosaki. She said, "You're welcome." And thank you, Terry. I appreciate that. She said that she met him once at a conference. Quote, "He's actually a pretty nice guy." He said in his presentation that the real reason the wealthy will continue to get richer is because they pay politicians to make laws that are beneficial to wealthy people. No, that is spot on accurate, absolute gospel truth. And amazing to me how cheap it is to buy a politician. And, you know, I had a friend who was a congressman from Illinois, and he said, "Look, no one ever bought my vote, but they bought my ear for 10 minutes at a time. So for that $2,000 donation, you get 10 or 15 minutes to use that congressman as your priest. to dump all of your wants and wishes and dreams and hopes onto in the hopes that they fall your way. And enough of you say that, they begin thinking that way. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Harry on line one from Chicago. Harry, how are you?
I'm well. So when Jack Welch was leaving GE, there were three men vying to replace him. It was Nardelli, McNerney, and I forget the third one. But what all these corporations, they all had backup plans, corporations they were going to go to. Like McNerney, instantly, since he didn't replace Jack Welch, he went to 3M. He tripled 3M stock, if I remember correctly. And then he was pretty much done there. And then they replaced the Boeing CEO because the Boeing CEO, unfortunately, monkeyed around with one of his underlings, let's call them. But anyways, the problem is that these CEOs get these huge compensations because everyone's vying for them because they think that they need them. And to a great extent, they don't. They're hoodwinking themselves into this. And one example is like the McDonald's CEO. They're always thinking of new sandwiches to come up with. And I went to school for business administration, and my concentration was in human resource management, just a little bit of background. But when you go to the McDonald's CEO, they're always coming up with all these new products to sell. But really what they need is to fire like 10 or 20% of their managers, because you go in there and they're nasty. Okay, they're not nice to their to the people that walk in. And a thing I came up with a couple of weeks ago is stop hating your customers, because you go in there and they treat you so poorly. So if they just kept the stores clean and the management nice and all the employees nice, that would business would be booming. But so are you still there?
Yeah, and I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you to get to the point where if you pay those people a decent wage, they'll be much happier. But go ahead.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry. I'm on a cell phone. And
yeah, I was waiting for you to say that if you paid them better, they'd be happier.
Who? The employees?
Yes.
Well, okay, so that's absolutely true. But what I took some of the first entrepreneurship classes and culture classes on determining the culture in a corporation. And one thing that we found out was that 90% of employees, and that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but we'll use it as a round number, they leave their jobs because they don't like their manager, not because they're underpaid or they don't like the hours or their job content, but it's because they don't like their manager. Okay, so they may say that they're underpaid, but that's only one aspect of it. When you have these nasty managers, I've gone into McDonald's and I don't go there often because they don't have salads anymore, but it's bad management that's causing McDonald's problems. Like when you go in and they don't have ice cream for days and weeks at a time. Well, McDonald's knows. They have computers. They know when a store has not sold any ice cream or any shake, and they still let that store get away with it. The zone manager lets them get away with it. They don't need these hyper-intelligent people that have been trained in Six Sigma and all these other things that they think they need. They need someone who's going to MBWE, management by wandering around, et cetera. So,
no, no, you're right. I'm with you. Good stuff, Harry. Appreciate it, man. He's right. He's spot on. And look, you know, the reality is you've got these people who are looking for things to do, trouble to make. You don't need to recreate McDonald's. You don't need new sandwiches or anything. What you got is that's the golden ticket, man. Do that really, really well and stick with that. So I agree with him. But, you know, here's the thing. And then it comes back down to this. You know, we end up management heavy. Worker light. We pay the people at the top enormously well, and the folks at the bottom who actually do the work, they're the ones who get shortchanged. And the weirdest thing is, you know, and I don't want to get all hung up on the McDonald's thing, because my experience has been, you know, it's the managers who are you know, just horribly angry and, you know, cracking the whip, and it's the workers who actually are the, you know, the people who are the lowest end of the spectrum. They're the nice people. They're the people who smile, and even though they're struggling to make ends meet, and you know that, because they're not making a decent wage, and they're taking you know what from above, and yet still they're still nice. I guess I struggle with that. But you know, on this CEO thing, this is I'm hoping we're at a juncture right now where we start looking upward. And you saw it also in the UPS strike, or the UPS talk of a strike when they were the contract fight. They were going after that CEO who was making, you know, enormous amounts of money, and the stock buybacks that were, you know, being done to pump up the price for the CEO. I'm hoping working people are paying attention to that. Because if anything, all of these worker actions, these are what seem to be the undercurrent. And I'm hoping there's some kind of cosmic plan to move us in this direction. I'm hoping there's some way to...
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming.